Thing and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On the Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SCR, nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program...
There's almost $3 trillion in Australia invested in superannuation, and that we only take 7% of that money to completely transform the whole economy towards renewable energy.
So, look, if you're thinking that your super has been kicking some mid-year goals, it might have been. But could Aussies have still been doing better? Also coming up on the show...
So if you're overworking, you're constantly, you know, spending no time with your family because you've got this thing tapping on the back of you going, you need more, you need to go.
Yeah, coming up on the show this week is...
How people can bounce back from adverse financial shock. What resources do we have? Do we have family and friends we can call on? Do we have the knowledge? Having had saved all of last year, I have enough in my kitty to pay it back. Do we have enough income to mediate that?
Yes, debt levels are at a 10-year high. Australians are in debt to the tune of twice as much as they earn. And this means there is precious little fat in the family budget due to the repayments that everyone has to make. So what happens if you have an emergency? We find out how you can be more financially resilient. And also on the program...
So imagine you're on a boat and your sunglasses are annoying you and they're falling off, or you know, you get spray on the lens. So it's actually a good option for people sailing.
Yeah, so all this and more coming up on The Money. But first, students are protesting at the University of Technology Sydney's decision to phase out traditional Chinese medicine courses within 2 years. The university claims the courses haven't made enough money. But protesters believe there are other reasons behind their decision. The expected closure has put into question the future of the students, teachers and even patients of the on-campus Chinese medicine clinic, as they are now forced to look elsewhere to complete their studies and therapies. Kevin Suarez has the story.
With news that the University of Technology Sydney will be phasing out courses on traditional Chinese medicine, students have protested on campus, asking for the closure to be reversed. Researchers have found that traditional Chinese medicine is an effective alternative to, or can be complementary to, modern medicine. For example, according to a study published in the Medical Journal of Australia in 2017, it found that acupuncture is as effective as medication to treating lower back pain and ankle sprains. Now, with news that UTS will no longer be offering courses on traditional Chinese medicine, students and related organisations are concerned that one of the most important universities that provides acupuncture and Chinese medicine specialists will impact the health industry. I asked recent graduate Chris how Chinese medicine works when compared to modern medicine.
Chinese medicine approaches diseases by the root cause and sees the relationship between the cause and effect, whereas in modern medicine, in my experience, I would take painkillers for maybe any back problems or any headaches that I've experienced, but this is only taking out the symptoms of my headaches and my other pains of where I'm having it. But it did not necessarily take out the root cause. It's only treating the cause and effects.
First-year student Georgia Lloyd explained how she felt getting the initial email announcing the phasing out of the course.
I initially heard about the closure with the first email from the dean. From that point, I was quite disturbed, having just started the course, so I kind of went to find a bit more clarity by reaching out to as many people as I can in UTS, only to be met with a brick wall. So then I found that was a bit of a systemic problem in UTS, so I wanted to search a bit harder just to see if anyone out there was willing to give me an actual chance to be heard, only to be met with answers of no decision has been made, we can't tell you this, we can't tell you that. And now in our new light, we realise that a decision was made about a month ago, so every effort to speak to them hasn't been met with any honesty.
She explained why UTS needed to be held accountable for this decision.
They allowed me to come into this degree and pay with my, not just my money, but my time, with zero intention of letting me actually complete this degree. So I feel as though they need to be accounted for that.
Speaking as a graduate, Chris shared his own thoughts about the announcement.
Since I've finished the course, I'm still ashamed to hear that many of my friends who are still doing the course, especially from first year to final year, getting the bad news that they're not able to finish the course, and this has mostly affected the first years. So I feel really ashamed that this is not only affecting them, but it's also affecting me as a graduate and other graduates too.
Many graduates rely on the reputation of the university they graduated from for future job prospects. However, Chris is concerned that graduates such as himself could face an uncertain career if UTS no longer offers this course.
So since I'm already practicing Chinese medicine as a graduate, it's also going to affect my long-term reputation, where if I was to treat patients who have already heard the news that Chinese medicine has been removed from UTS, why should they come to me for first priority treatment, right? There's, if you've had something that's given you like a lot of tragedy, why should we come to you first rather than come to see a GP or come to see another practitioner who could possibly has not been affected by the government or by people getting cancelled, yeah.
But it's not only graduates who are concerned about their future in healthcare around Australia. According to a statement by the Chinese Medicine and Acupuncture Society, closures such as this will further strain the Australian healthcare system.
The UTS discussion to exit the Chinese medicine has very serious consequences for the Australian community. The first, a significant decrease in new Chinese medicine practitioners and acupuncturists. Second, the Australian public to have reduced choice in health services. Third, the Australian public relying more heavily on an already strained national health system, resulting in greater net spend in the end by the federal government. As a public university funded by taxpayers, we consider it is UTS obligation and responsibility to help benefit the community.
The wider community has taken to traditional Chinese medicine, according to the statement.
According to the RMIT study, Australians spend $4.13 billion Australian dollar, which greatly reduced the financial burden on the national healthcare system due to increasing of acupuncture education, supervision and research. Australia is in no doubt at the forefront of Western country for acupuncture.
Ms. Lloyd explained why she chose UTS over other local universities and colleges that offered courses in traditional Chinese medicine.
Because of the reputation. It's been running this course for nearly 26 years. It's highly regarded across the whole world. So for me, there was no other option. I'd tried private colleges before, and I know that the standard of education, the quality there, actually isn't as good. And for me, it's not accessible to go to Western Sydney. And everything that they're offering as part of this degree is exactly what I accepted the offer for.
She says this closure will affect the future of other first-year students who had expected to complete this course at UTS.
I don't know where I'm going. They've offered me no transitional plan for where I can study. I can't make it out to Western Sydney, so am I going to have to redecide my future? They've consumed my time and many of my peers' times when their care is not just for kids, but for ailing parents and family members.
Chris feels the reputation of traditional Chinese medicine has improved recently, but is worried that closures such as this could change that.
There has been, you know, a growing reputation in the past that Chinese medicine can give hope for people that have really chronic issues, and this has actually saved a lot of people, even my family, even my friends all around the world. I've even tried introducing this concept to friends that I've met throughout my whole university life and throughout my travelling life as well, and I just don't want to see a time where Chinese medicine is going to die in terms of its reputation, and everyone is going to go back to maybe modern practice and never seek of any other alternatives that could possibly do better.
Yeah, Chris, there, a recent UTS graduate, ending that report by Kevin Suarez. We've actually asked the UTS faculty for comment and they have provided a statement outlining reasons online. So I'm Roderick Chambers and you're listening to On the Money throughout Australia on the Community Radio Network. Well, with debt levels in Australia at all-time highs, many people are finding that they have nothing to fall back on when unexpected expenses arise. Whether it's medical, mechanical, or monetary, we all have emergencies, so we need to be a bit more resilient. Sid Sharma finds out how we can do it.
Australian households have a problem, a debt problem. Our debt-to-income ratio is at an all-time high, reaching almost 200% in recent months. And what this means is that the typical Australian household owes twice as much as they earn. And it's happening for a multitude of factors. A volatile housing market, slow wage growth, and a weak job sector are all of the usual suspects.
Right now in Australia, the household debt-to-income ratio is 194%. It's the highest in the last 10 years. And what does that mean? It means that 10 years ago, people were not taking that much amount of debt on.
This is Dr. Archana Vula from UNSW. She's a research fellow at the Center for Social Impact and specializes in financial resilience, social inequality, and policy.
It's important because it just shows you there are so many people in Australia who cannot put together $500 in a case of emergency, which is quite astonishing and shocking.
One in five Australians doesn't have access to an emergency $500 of their own savings, which is quite worrisome.
You're just a tire puncher away, for example, from getting into a debt trap.
And with a tightened banking sector still reeling from the Royal Commission and its flow-on effects, the resulting phenomenon is that we're seeing a lot more debt-stressed Australians turning to alternative forms of securing credit outside of the traditional banking sector. Paydays, which can have effective interest rates of upwards of 400% per annum. With fewer regulations around lending practices and exorbitant interest requirements, these businesses have been called out as being predatory by many, including the Consumer Action Law Centre and members of Parliament. A social lending proposal from the Mikkel Institute published in 2017 has been making the rounds again as the Senate inquiry into payday loans stagnates. The proposal details a new government-run social emergency lending service, allowing Australians on less than $100,000 a year access to loans of up to $500, with a quick approval process, a low interest rate tied to the government's own cost of funds, and a repayment system that would be made through the tax system, similar in mechanism to HECS.
If you had the government giving you that money, you can smooth that emergency situation and not fall into a trap. So I think rather than not having anything, having that as a minimum guarantee from your government is a fantastic proposal.
The system is aimed at increasing the financial resilience of Australians in debt-stricken times. But what exactly is financial resilience?
Financial resilience basically captures how people can bounce back from adverse financial shock. How do we bounce back? What resources do we have? Do we have family and friends we can call on? Do we have the knowledge that actually, hey, having had saved all of last year, I have enough in my kitty to pay it back? Do we have enough income to mediate that? Do we have other kind of things we can draw on, like products and services, like, for example, getting a personal loan from the bank? All these things are resources you need to have in your kitty to bounce back. And financial resilience is that idea which tells you, hey, yes, you can bounce back.
But really, should we be aiming for more than a lending service? We're seeing a shifting focus away from looking at problems in an isolated, economic way to more of a systems approach. Indeed, a social lending service has its merits, but may not address the broader issues that are exacerbating household debt in the first place.
One way to think about this debt, is think about in terms of, is it a band-aid solution or is it a cure to the disease, right? So if we are thinking about helping him smooth the next emergency crisis mode, then yes, that $500 is important. That jump, right? But what is it that we can think about in terms of cure for the disease? Like, what else is going on? And unemployment is a huge issue there. At what point can intervention happen outside of that immediate money hardship? What points around that vulnerability can be a point of intervention and help is what we need to think about. So I think we need to think about debt beyond the numbers and economics of it, but what is the social impact of being in debt? And therefore, when you think more broader than the economics, you can potentially see what levers outside of money you can pull to make a change.
One of the problems is that Australians don't have equitable access to broader financial products, which can help bolster resilience.
High cost, high value products that you also need to engage in the financial marketplace. That's what's missing. And in terms of equitable access, there are many barriers, such as what's the cost of getting to the bank? What's the wait time for appointments? What about poor customer service? All those have costs, and all those make it inequitable to access finance. By not having equitable financial product services and economic resources to even begin with, I think we're finding ourselves every day and even going forward they're going to be more and more in debt.
Broadly speaking, we also need to tackle our wages and income levels. These play a big part in financial resilience and in our own need to take on debt.
I think the bigger problem here is the lack of ability to pay cost of living. The wages, there's been no real growth in the wages to keep up with the cost of living. And really, if you're looking in the job market, how many jobs are there, right? So if you cannot get the basic income, you really cannot survive.
And finally, the bane of every dinner party conversation, the price of housing in Australia, particularly in big cities such as Sydney, plays an undeniably important role in indebting households.
It's also to do with housing affordability, which is a huge issue in Australia. And those two are tightly linked because majority of the debt is mortgage stress or rental payment stress.
How do we go about creating a holistic solution to our household debt crisis in Australia? It might, for one, require the help of more than just government to create policy.
Financial marketplace is complex with multiple players. Therefore, you need multiple complex solutions. And I think the business sector has a great opportunity to fill in those white spaces.
Research from the UNSW Centre for Social Impact is looking at new, innovative ways of tackling household debt, including building mechanisms into the household-business interface.
Working with organisations at organisational level to create commitments for social, for financial inclusion. So, for example, one of the things they push energy companies or financial services sector companies is to create a hardship policy. What have you done with your customers when they ring up and say, hey, listen, I can't pay my arrears this week? So can you, what systems do you have in place? Can they quickly be sent to hardship management teams? Can they be referred to a counselor, a social worker? So a bank doesn't have to think about all this. But hey, if you make a commitment to think about this, maybe you will look for that person in the customer. Embed ideas of trust, fairness, dignity. That's one thing often people talk about, not having dignity in how they're dealt with during conversations about debt. So these are ways in which you can embed by creating commitments amongst organizations.
Dr. Archie Navulia, research fellow from the UNSW Center for Social Impact, ending that report by Sid Sharma. You're listening to On the Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers.
From Hobart to Alice Springs, from Woodend to Taree, this is On the Money, making sense out of all those dollars.
And now on the Money, it's business time.
It's business time. It's business time.
It's business. It's business time.
I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time.
Ooh, it's business. It's business time.
Yeah, and many people who wear glasses have often decided to get prescription transition lenses for outdoor wear so that they can have sunglasses that are made to their sight without running around with extra pairs in their pockets or having bags and that sort of thing. But what about if you're a contact lens wearer? Well, actually, it now seems that technology has caught up with those as well, and people with contacts can do the same thing. I asked Johnson & Johnson's Sean McKernan to explain how this all worked.
The product is called AccuView Oasys with Transitions, and we actually made it or created it in conjunction with Transitions Optical. So Transitions Optical are the ones that create the spectacle lens. So we actually had a partnership for about 10 years. It took 10 years to develop. And yeah, create this lens that incorporates a contact lens with the same Transitions technology.
And so it actually darkens or prevents some of the UVA and UVB from getting through to your own iris and lens.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because it's actually a new dimension for a contact lens. So what it does is actually manages light for you. So you have visible light. So if you're going outside and you're in the sunlight or if you're inside, under bright lights indoors and then driving at night. So it actually filters the light for you, so it accommodates and seamlessly transitions your vision. And then the other part that you mentioned is correct is the UV protection. So filters up to about 100% of UVA and UVB. So it's actually the highest level of UV protection you can get from a contact lens today.
Why is that important? Yeah.
You know, like everyone, you spend time outside, and most of us on a daily basis are bothered by light. So there's times when you're outside and you're running or playing sport or cricket or tennis, and obviously sunglasses. This isn't a replacement for sunglasses at all. Obviously sunglasses play a big role, but there's times it's just not practical to wear sunglasses. So, you know, if you're jogging and your glasses are bouncing around and it's not comfortable, so this is an option for you to actually manage light while you're doing some form of activity. And that's the obvious one. But it has broad applications as well. For example, we did a study with QUT, so the university in Queensland, looking at nighttime driving. And the lens actually helps you with your vision at night. So you're bothered by oncoming traffic lights or the other cars. So it helps with your vision, but also can help with sight recognition as well.
So is that glare or is it actually... Yeah, okay, right.
Yeah, so it sort of manages the visible light for you. So the study that they did found that you can actually see a street sign 17 metres earlier wearing the contact lens compared to when you're not wearing the lens at all.
So it's kind of much safer, isn't it? Really, is there any reason why you wouldn't have it done if you're getting new lenses?
I guess it's up to the preference of the consumer, but there's no real watch outs for this. I mean, it's pretty innovative. I mean, it was voted by Time magazine in the US as one of the greatest inventions of 2018. So they listed the top 50, and this was amongst the, you know, we have driverless electric cars and a lot of other great innovations out there at the moment. So it's really it's really an interesting product for us.
So it'd be great for active sports people too, wouldn't it? You know, if you're places where you could wear glasses, physical glasses are perhaps dangerous or difficult to have.
Yeah, that's an interesting space for us is performance. So we've actually tested this with a few cricketers. So Jason Crazier, who used to play cricket for Australia, was one of the early people that tried the lens for us. It certainly has a lot of application in sport and high-performance sport, but also for... typical people on their everyday activity that just want to manage light.
And can you see it? Like if someone's wearing them, can you see them like in the sun? Do they their eyes look a bit of a darker colour? Or
yeah, there is a mild aesthetic to it. So when it's always on, so when you're indoors, it's activated as well, and you can't really see it indoors. But when you're outside in bright light, you can see the lens on your eye a little bit.
How does it work? Like, is it part of the molecules that make up the plastics involved, or is it a separate thing that goes across? How does it work?
Yeah, you're right. It's photochromatic molecules that are embedded in the lens matrix. So what happens is these molecules are inside the lens, and then when light passes through the molecules, they transform and they change. So what happens is when it's in light, it actually darkens and at the same time filters the light as it passes through to your eye. So you're right, it is. It's molecules built into the lens that activate with light.
And what about with water sports and things? Are they likely to wash out? Or?
Yeah, so look, with any contact lens, we generally advise don't wear them swimming or don't wear them in water. And if you do, replace them immediately because it's actually quite dangerous. I mean, people need to be careful about water sports with contact lenses because you actually get bacteria and other sort of nasties in your eye. So, yeah.
But what about like sailing where you might get spray but not really immersed, you know?
Yeah.
That's the same thing?
Generally okay. So generally one of the applications is for sailors, right? So you imagine you're on a boat and your sunglasses are annoying you and they're falling off or, you get spray on the lens. So it's actually a good option for people sailing.
So do you find people are interested in them that actually don't need any vision correction and they just want them for the ease of use?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. So we launched this product in the US in April. In Australia and New Zealand, it's only been since the last couple of weeks, 1st of July. But what they found in the US early on is about a third of the people buying this lens don't even need vision correction. So it's taking contact lenses from a refractive tool, so for correcting vision, to something much broader. So it actually has applications for everyone that wants to manage light, not only people that need vision correction.
So if you're a full-on gamer or you're an internet hacker and you're on the screens day and night, does it filter out the blue light as well?
Yeah, so that's one of the other parts of the lens. So it manages all visible light, which includes blue light. So it does filter blue light also.
What sort of costs do you look at for this sort of thing? Is it expensive?
It's not too bad, actually. So we built this on what we call our reusable platform. So it's a lens you wear daily, but you throw it away every 2 weeks.
All right, so it's
a reusable lens. It makes it a lot more affordable. So, for example, three pairs. So one box, you get three pairs, and that costs $79, which would last you about 6 weeks.
Oh, okay.
You're a full-time wearer. So not too bad.
What are you predicting the take-up of this is going to be then in terms of your business?
I think in the US, they were sharing their about 17% of their expectations, 17% ahead of their plans. And for us, it's been a couple of weeks. So we've had a lot of interest. I mean, the optometrists we're talking to, very excited. And as they start to talk to their patients and consumers, obviously there's a lot of interest as well. But look, it's really an exciting time for the industry. I think for contact lenses in general, I mean, they've really come a long way in the last 10 years. You know, they're a lot softer, easier to insert and remove, and more comfortable. You can wear them for longer, much healthier. And so this is just the next level again of bringing something that's totally new, a totally new category to contact.
Yeah, quite new. And that's Sean McKernan from Johnson & Johnson speaking with me there. Yeah, so that's about all we have time for on The Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business, and the economy. Thanks to our producer for the first program there, Kevin Suarez, and also Sid Sharma. On The Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2 SER for the Community Radio Network. And you can find all of our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Subscribe to our podcasts. Now, they're available anywhere on anything at the moment, I think. So also follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2ser and find us on Facebook and Instagram for updates. I'm Roderick Chambers. It's been great being with you, and we're going to be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
Get enough of our tunes? Head to the Old Clare Bar on Wednesdays for Spin Out and catch all your favourite 2SER DJs live on the decks. The next instalment on July 31 features DJs Piero and Tierra Boo from When the Levee Breaks. Come grab the $5 schooner of the day, some midweek dinner, or just enjoy the tunes. Spin Out at the Clare Bar Wednesdays in July and August from 5 till 9 p.m. 2SER is a partner of Spin Out.
Songwriters, it's time to get paid. APRA AMCOS needs your performance reports by July 31 to pay you for playing live. Just log into your account and let them know when, where, and what you've played, and they'll do the rest. Not a member? It's free to join. Just head to apraamcos.com.au to sign up and start earning. APRA AMCOS sponsors 2SER 107.3.